every man's life ends the same way. It is only the details of how he lived and how he died that distinguish one man from another. Ernest Hemingway.
You know, he'd have his head down and kind of moving it from side to side, and he kind of looked my way and then just kind of start walking my way and then stop and then kind of shift around. And so I had this feeling like, oh, well, he notices me, so what's going to happen? I thought, you know, statistically no hikers died from a grizzly bear attack, so how am I going to be the one? You know, I was like, yeah, as far as stats go, I should be A-okay. And sure enough, he decides to charge me, and I was like, oh, so well, this is how I go. But, you know, me being the fighter type and everything, I always had this fantasy of dying fighting, the warrior's death kind of thing. And so it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, now I'm getting what I wanted. I was kind of disappointed I wasn't going to be a triple crowner, but I was like, well, this is it.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week on the trail, dirt bags and hiker trash. I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Let's start off with a reminder. If you are enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. All right, let's get to this week's guest, who is a triple crowner with more than 10,000 trail miles under his feet. Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod, Wesley Tills. How's it going, Wesley?
Yeah, going good. Yeah.
Okay. And as we talk tonight, you are calling in from Missouri near Kansas City.
Yeah. The Kansas City area. Yep.
Okay. And he tells me that there is a storm about to enter the area. And so if you hear some thunder, and if you're watching the YouTube broadcast, if you see some lightning flashes, that it just makes it all that more dramatic. So stay tuned for that. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Wesley, here on the podcast, we go strictly by trail names if you've picked one up. So I have to imagine that with more than 10,000 trail miles, you have probably picked up a trail name.
I have. I went through a few, but the one that stuck is Mega Man.
Okay. And we love to hear the story behind the trail name. How did you end up with Mega Man?
Yeah, so it was on the Appalachian Trail. I was going southbound, so that's the first hint to the name. Because, you know, for the Appalachian Trail, there's people say if they're going from Maine to Georgia, it's Mega. If you're going from Georgia to Maine, it's Game. For the initials, Maine is ME, Georgia's GA. So I was going southbound, so that's the first part about it, Mega. And I grew up, whenever I was a kid, I was very much into like retro gaming, playing the NES and stuff. So Mega Man was a big series that I enjoyed. And then the third part about it was at the time I had a stress fracture and I was hobbling on the side of my foot and everyone's telling me I need to get off trail. And I kept telling them I don't want to go back home. So I was just hobbling along with a stress fracture in my foot. And so someone put it all together and he's like, you're outpacing most of the hikers, you're a nerdy guy, and you're going southbound, you're Mega Man. So that's how it happened.
You know what, I am always learning something, because you said that, you know, I our listeners may be able to figure it out, and maybe more people that have experience with the AT would be able to figure that out, but this is the first time that I put that together, that, you know, Maine going southbound is Maine to Georgia, and you take the state abbreviations and it's Mega. So yeah. It's like, you know, light bulb goes off for me. Thank you.
Yeah. No, that was something that I discovered. I ran into a hiker whose trail name was Omega, and I didn't think much about it. And then whenever she explained it, that it was because she was going southbound and the whole, you know, abbreviations, I was kind of blown by that. And so then when someone told me I should be Mega Man, I was absolutely thrilled for that name. So
nice. And who gave you the name? Do you remember?
Yeah, his name was Jetpack, and he's actually from Kodiak Island, Alaska. So, yeah.
Okay, nice. Now, you mentioned you were a gamer.
I, or at least was. I still game occasionally, but I since hiking, I think with gaming, you know, growing up, it was about escaping, going into a world that was a lot better. And now that I'm into hiking, it's like I'm already in that world. So I don't really need games to compensate for that.
That is a great analogy. That's fantastic. Yeah. What games did you play? What were some of your favorite games back in the day?
Well, one that always stuck with me because so I'm 29 years old, born in 93. And so around my generation early on, we had the PlayStation. So Crash Bandicoot, Spyro the Dragon, those were big for me. The Final Fantasy series, 7 and 9 were kind of my favorites. And then just a lot of the old games I really enjoyed, Contra, Bubble Bobble, Dig Dug, some of the arcade style. I really like games I can just pick up, play for 30 minutes, put it down and carry on with my day. I do enjoy the longer games too, like Skyrim and stuff, but that I can be pretty addicted to that kind of stuff. And so I try to keep away from it just to, you know, make my life more meaningful.
Now, what does it say about me that I recognize Dig Dug? And I recognize Dig Dug from the days when I played it in the donut shop lobby.
That's awesome. Good on you. It's a good game.
Yeah, I remember that and Asteroids. I'm really dating myself here. And, you know, one of earlier than what the games that you mentioned, Doom was real big when I was probably in my early 20s. And we had some friends and we got into that for a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I played Doom, but I was a little bit past that. So it was GoldenEye was our big first-person shooter game growing up.
Got it. All right. Hey, we've got a real treat today because I've thrown something into the episode that I occasionally do when I find something out there that catches my eye.
It's time for a current event.
Okay. So if I see something in the headlines related to hiking or camping, or some kind of outdoor adventure that really kind of catches me, I will bring it up here. And we call it our current event. And this is from the Olympian in Washington. Cool. And this story just kind of grabs you right at a very visceral level. So the headline is that a woman falls headfirst into a vault toilet, calls 911 to pull her out. And so let me just give you the details, and then I want to hear your reaction and what maybe your thoughts, and if you find yourself in a similar situation. Yeah. So evidently she was, may have been at a trailhead, and obviously there was not a lot of other people around because she didn't call for help for them. She called on her phone, but she dropped her phone into the toilet. And so a vault toilet is a waterless, non-flush toilet typically found at campgrounds and near hiking trails where human waste is stored in an airtight underground container. So she tried to, she dismantled the toilet, took off the seat and took off the sitting part. And so it was just a hole there and she tried to fish it out. And evidently she just out of reach. She couldn't quite reach it. She leaned in a little bit further and she went in head first. And after about 15 to 20 minutes of trying to get out and being unsuccessful, she called 911. Now, usually this is a highbrow podcast. You know, we really don't get into the low humor. I'm kidding. I'm being sarcastic here. But this story was just too good to pass up. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I would imagine if you could like equate it to like a Dungeons and Dragons scenario, she rolled double ones, you know, or she rolled a one on a 20 die. She rolled the absolute worst roll she could for retrieving her phone. That's extremely unfortunate. It sounds like she was trying to do everything she could. Maybe the seat itself was kind of getting in the way or the lid, so she had to remove it. That's understandable. But yeah, I'd say nothing wrong on her part, just, you know, clumsiness, but man, that is sad. I'm wondering if she has a partner or somebody at home. She comes back home just reeking of human fluids and just their reaction to it. I mean, also, did she throw up, you know, because you're just stuck
in so many questions. Yes.
Yeah. It just seems so unfortunate. I wonder,
you equated it to a one on a 20 die for Dungeons and Dragons. That's great. It's like we're role playing a game here. And oh, sorry. You know, the question is, you've just dropped your phone into the toilet. What do? I mean, you roll the dice and oh, I see, you have fallen into the toilet head first. I'm sorry.
I've fallen and I can't get up. Oh, that's terrible.
But obviously, I mean, if the toilet was in place and she, there's no way she could reach down through the toilet and have any chance of getting the phone. So she tried to get herself closer to the phone by taking that piece of the equation out of play.
Yeah.
But evidently it was just beyond her reach. And she shifted the wrong way, shifted with an F, the wrong way and fell in.
Yeah. Terrible, terrible.
Unfortunately. And we just finished talking about trail names. I mean, what if she had been with a group? I mean, she could have had a spectacular trail name.
Yeah. Yeah. There would have been a lot of opportunities. I can't come up with one right off the top of my head, but it reminds me of just like bobbing for apples or something. Somebody like turd bopping or whatever.
Well, let's let that simmer. Maybe when we get to the end of the episode, we can see if anything has floated to the surface in terms of a trail name for her.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Mega Man, have you had a chance to listen to the podcast at all?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So I only asked to make sure that you are aware of a segment that happens towards the end of the episode called our Pro Tip Inside of the Week. That's where I will turn to you and ask you to share some trail wisdom with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. So don't be surprised when we get there.
All right. Sounds good. Okay.
And of course, the expectation is all throughout this episode, you'll be dropping trail wisdom, but you'll still be on the hook for that one, that official one at the end.
Cool. Sounds good.
Okay.
The must bring gear review.
Oh, there's Half Calf, my youngest daughter. She is American from Southern California, and she loves to put on what she thinks is an English accent. The jury's still out on that, but helping us with the segment introductions. It's time for the must bring gear review, sponsored by the Ultralight Backpacking Gear Company, Six Moon Designs. And here's how it works. If you were to let a stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for a multi-day hike, what is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you've got a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So Mega Man, what is your must bring piece of gear?
So the thing I was wondering is, would shoes be included with that, or is it just had to be something within your pack?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's not an uncommon question either.
Okay.
Gear can apply to anything that you bring with you on a hike.
Yeah.
So it could be shoes, could be clothing, could be your bag. It could be what's in your bag. It's all up to you. We want to hear your personal choice here. What's most important?
Yeah. Then I definitely pick my shoes because there's so often where, you know, everyone's going to try to assume, oh, these are the good shoes. And especially with hiking, and if it's just generic gear, I'm guessing that's going to be like high top boots or something. And I've hiked in those before, and it's a lot of blisters, at least for my feet. I've switched around. I just got off the Florida trail, and I had these all terrains for them, and I bought them for about $50. The Florida Trail Association was recommending it, and they lasted me all 1100 miles, and I'm still wearing them. And they're, you know, I'm not a picky hiker. I can, you know, until my shoes, I can feel the ground on my feet. I'm not throwing them away. And those shoes are, yeah, pretty good. So after having those shoes, I'd say that would be my pick, is like some good all terrains. Just, they're cheap, they're nice, they're comfy. I didn't have any blisters. So yeah, that'd be my choice.
Okay. Do they have any kind of rock plate or thicker sole to avoid those stepping on those stones and feeling them?
Not really. They're pretty generic, to be honest. You know, and that's something that I kind of go for with my shoes, is I want simple design, because I often find the more functions and more things to it, the more that things can go wrong long term. And so I kind of prefer things to just be, you know, really good at the basics. So
okay. Yeah. All right. And they lasted 1100 miles and you still got them.
Yeah, wearing them every day. So,
well, that's a good endorsement right there.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the hiking pole.
Okay. And to help us continue talking about gear, we're gonna I've got seven questions for you in what we call the hiking poll. And it's POLL, like a survey, not POLE, like a trekking pole. Mm. You think that's clever?
That is clever. Yeah.
I came up with that. Yeah.
Oh, well, good on you.
And so I'm going to ask you seven questions, and it's going to help me give you a score from 1 to 100 on the sanity scale, with 100 being completely sane and 1 being completely bonkers. And you have to know right off the bat that there is a 20-point automatic deduction for being a long trail through hiker. So if you've done any one of the three American trails, long trails, then you know, your highest score possible is 80. You've done all three. So I don't know if that's an additional deduction or not. We'll see how the poll goes.
Cool. Sounds good.
Okay. All right. First question's easy. Trekking poles or no trekking poles?
It's in between. I prefer one trekking pole, my pimp cane. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. Tell me about this. That's an unusual answer. I'm used to either one or the other, but just one pole. That's kind of a unique answer.
Yeah. I like having one hand to help grind me up mountains and then the other hand to deal with whatever the world is throwing at me, whether that's mosquitoes I need to swat or I need to eat a Cliff Bar while walking, whatever it is, you know. And so I kind of like to have both, or switch a song on Spotify if I'm jamming to tune. So it's nice just to have that. And then honestly, just for me, I like the aesthetic of a one trekking pole look. It just makes me feel very dignified while I'm hiking. So I'm a one pole guy.
Dignified pimp cane. Nice.
Yeah.
Now, just to clarify, you're not swatting the mosquitoes with the single pole. You're swatting them with your free hand. You're not like Mr. Miyagi catching the fly with the chopsticks.
Yeah, no, I didn't fence growing up, so I'm not the best whenever it comes to accurate sword swinging.
You know, I wonder sometimes if I'm the only one that, you know, as I'm hiking along and my head's down and I've got my poles, that to pass the time, I'll see how accurate I can be with, you know, like stabbing a leaf on the trail or piece of bark. Is that just me or do other people do that as well?
No, I definitely do that too. A lot of times too, I like, you know, if there's a stump, I really like to see if I can just stab it in the center and get to stick. That's a very sad, it's just like, you know, a sensation thing for me. It gives a good satisfaction when it kind of, you can feel that it's lodged in there a little bit. Decaying, any kind of decaying wood, it's just nice to stick it in. Or what else do I do? There's I can't remember. When I get bored, I do all kinds of stupid stuff on my trekking poles. Of course, twirling it around, trying to get better at that, imagining that I'm a like Polynesian fire dancer, but you know.
Nice. Yeah. All right, next question. Boots or trail runners? I think I know the answer to this question.
Yeah, I definitely pick trail runners there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If the feet aren't happy, nobody's happy.
That's right.
Okay. Your preferred shelter system, tent, tarp, hammock, bivy, or cowboy camping?
Preferred is definitely cowboy camping. I love sleeping under the stars if there's no mosquitoes. And if it's not raining, I will cowboy camp almost every night. For instance, on the CDT, I probably cowboy camped, I don't know, 100 nights of it. Maybe, you know, it took me 119 days to do the trail. So there's, yeah, probably 15 to 19 days where I actually set up my tent. But you got to make it really uncomfortable for me to do that. And even if it's cold, I'll still cowboy camp. If it's just gets cold enough, I'll grab over my tent, the rain fly, and I'll just put that over my sleeping bag. And that secures the heat well enough for me. So.
Okay. What about those people who say, you know, there might be a critter that gets close to me, like a snake or something, or a scorpion?
Well, yeah. I mean, those guys, most of the time I like to do it just for like, also for the bigger critters, you know, like if a mountain lion or bear or whatever, I'm able to get up and chase it off real quick. I want to be able to see the animal and face it and scare it off kind of thing. But whenever it comes to snakes and scorpions, I don't think you can get up and scream at them and they'll run away. I haven't had that problem yet, but if I did, it might make me start second guessing cowboy camping, at least like in like desert settings or areas with a lot of snakes. But
right. That's an interesting perspective, because I know I've talked to a lot of people who say that, you know, they know it's irrational, but they feel like they're better protected from bears or mountain lions while they're in the tent, even though they know it's a very thin membrane between them and the animal, but they just, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And your perspective is, I want to see it coming. I want to be able to get up quick and let it know I'm here. Let it know that I'm here and scare it away.
Yeah, I don't want it to get comfortable. That's one thing that I think whenever you have your tent up, you know, a lot of times I've done that and then you hear a bear or whatever come by and you're sitting there listening and trying to assess what should I do. And that's just, you know, at that point, the bear is kind of like, oh, you know, this is a comfortable area. Nothing's happening. But if he comes by and the minute that he comes by, you jump up and you go, get out of here. And then the bear's like, oh, shoot. You know, it's a good jump scare. So it's worked for me every time. So that's how I like to do it.
Okay. Now, how about your sleeping system, sleeping bag or quilt?
I'm a sleeping bag kind of guy. That's mainly just because I haven't gone quilt yet. I'd be willing to try it. I'm not opposed to it, but I'm just comfortable. Sleeping bag works, so I just stick to sleeping bag.
Okay. And are you a side sleeper, back sleeper?
What am I? I'm kind of, you know, my body gets numb all throughout the night on trail. And so I'm all over the place. Whichever arm gets numb, then I have to rotate to the other side. So, I think initially I'm sleeping on my belly. A lot of times for me, unless I'm so exhausted, if I'm so exhausted, I can sleep on my back and I'm out. But there's something about sleeping with my neck conked, which is probably not the best, but it puts me to sleep quicker. It's almost like I'm putting myself in a headlock or something and cutting off oxygen flow, and then helps me go to sleep. At least that's my theory on why it works so well for me. But
you know what? I'm going to write that down because I always have problems sleeping on the trail. You know, even when I'm exhausted, I toss and turn. If I just knew that secret a little bit earlier about putting yourself in a chokehold and cutting off the blood supply to the brain, I'd sleep a lot better out there. That's great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. This next question, very important, Mega Man. This is a dangerous question, major deduction if you answer it incorrectly. So be careful here. In terms of food, are you a stove guy, cold soak or stoveless?
See, here's where I fail the test. I'm a stoveless guy. I've always been stoveless. I have never cooked on trail. It's mainly just I have not built the habit of it. And I'm just a snack guy too. I don't even cold soak. I guess if you include Idaho and mashed potatoes, that's the only issue I have with like the general sense of cold soaking is like, for instance, ramen noodles. It's an investment. You put it in, wait a couple hours, and then it's ready. And I don't think that far ahead on trail. So, I'm a stoveless kind of guy. Always have been. I've camped out for over 500 nights. Any night that's a crappy cold night, I'm shivering, and my friend is eating a nice hot ramen bomb. I'm sitting there being a little envious, but at the same time, I'm pretty good at yogiing at this point. So I can normally look pathetic enough to where they're like, oh, I'm kind of full. You want some? And so if I have a trail family near me, I get the best of both worlds. I don't have to cook and I get good food.
Yogiing. I love it. That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Finish this for me. Don't finish it. Agree or disagree? Life is, that doesn't count either. I'm not even going to give you any direction on this. I'm just going to say it and then you can do what you want. Life is better above or below the tree line.
Oh man. Yeah, this was the one that I was debating in my head for so long, and it's so hard for me to know because I feel like below the tree line, there's more species, and it's really fun to see the diversity of life. On the higher elevations, you're not going to get a terrible lot of things. You know, once you're above tree line, there's not trees, for instance, and a lot less bugs and cool things to look at. At the same time, you don't get as many irritating bugs and things. It's hard to say. Like on the Florida Trail this year, whenever I was down in Ocala National Forest, for instance, and I'm walking through these tall grasslands and stuff, I was just baffled by how beautiful it is. I really enjoy beautiful grasslands, but the being up on the mountains and the amazing views, that's awesome too. I just like anything that's wildernessy, as long as there's not people and there's Mother Earth and lots of life all over it. I'm a happy camper. So it's a tough one. I'm going to probably give a slight edge though to above the tree line, just because, you know, that's where all the good photos generally are done, and being able to see vast landscapes is a really satisfying thing. So yeah, above the tree line.
Okay. Above, but it's close. It's a close call.
It's very close. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Last question. What's more important, pack weight or luxury items?
I would say that it's probably pack weight. I'm not an ultralight hiker. That's mainly a financial thing because I live to hike. I don't, and there's a level of, oh, you have to wait for hiking if you want to save up for the nice gear. So I'm kind of just get the janky poor man's gear and just make it work because I don't live for the gear. I live for the trails. But I'm not an ultralight hiker. I'd say my base weight is probably around 14 pounds. But still, you know, being stoveless and without several things that most hikers normally have, I would say that I'm probably more about being on the lightweight side.
Okay. This answer to this question is not going to count against you or for you either way, but just in terms of ultralight, are you the kind of guy that has a full-size toothbrush, a half-size toothbrush, a toothbrush with holes drilled in the handle, or you just use your finger to clean your teeth?
I just grab a toothbrush. And a lot of times, seeing this one I've been really criticized on is I'll just go to Walmart and buy the AIM giant tube of toothpaste and just like for a long multi-month trail. And I'm like, oh, you know, that'll last me the whole trail. That way I don't have to think about toothpaste. So that's where it's like, I'm not on the lightweight side as I'm carrying a giant tub of toothpaste and a full toothbrush. But you know, if it's not uncomfortable to you, it's not a big deal. And it's not uncomfortable to me to carry that little bit extra.
So. Okay. Well said. All right. Let me do some math here. Calculate the total. Yeah. I carry the 3. I'm dividing by the square root of 2, multiply that by pi and adjust for the height of Mount Whitney. And you come out with a solid 62. I think that's just the right amount of crazy for a triple crowner. I mean, that's satisfying right there.
Sounds very healthy. I'm satisfied with that indeed.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. Hey, before we get too far down the trail, let's back up a little bit. Love to hear about your background, where you grew up. Was camping or hiking part of your family culture? And what kinds of sports and hobbies you played?
Cool. Yeah. So to start off, I grew up in the Kansas City area. All my life, the place where we're filming right now, this is the house I grew up in since I was 4 years old. I have 10 siblings, 6 brothers, 4 sisters. Currently, I'm a uncle of 22 kids. So I never want to have kids because there's enough of my lineage to be passed on at this point. My mom's from Denmark and my dad's from Kansas. They met in Kansas City. And I grew up. And then, as far as like outdoor stuff, it was a big thing for us growing up. One of the things, and this will make sense with like the big family and then what I'm about to say, but I grew up Mormon. That was theologically, we grew up in the Mormon church. And so we'd go on a lot of vacations out to Utah, especially like Zion's National Park. I have a lot of family that lives down in Hurricane, Leverkin, Cedar City, that kind of area in the Southwest part. And so almost yearly, we would go to Colorado and then Southern Utah. And that was always a big thing for me. I was always really comfortable in my body. So I would, run and climb up mountains. I remember at 6 years old was my first mountain, quote unquote, which was Angel's Landing. And for some people, that's considered a scary hike, and especially like on the parts you're supposed to use the chains. But I didn't like the lines of people. So to let them go by, I just climbed on the side of it and let people pass by. And my dad,
age 6.
Yeah. Yeah. And my dad screaming at me, "You're going to die. You're going to die." And that's kind of a lot of my upbringing, is my parents yelling at me, "You're going to die," because I'm doing something reckless. But I've always just been so comfortable in my body that I was like, I'm fine. And yet to this day, I've never really broken a bone besides my nose. So I'd say I'm being confident in yourself has really worked well. But also I grew up in Boy Scouts. That's a very Mormon thing to do. And we would take yearly trips, little high adventures. I was mainly down in the Ozarks area, so going down the Buffalo River, or doing like bicycling the Katy Trail. I remember actually whenever I was like 12 years old, there was this guy walking on the Katy Trail, and he's telling us that he's walking the whole thing, and it's 255 miles. And whenever he left, me and all the other Boy Scouts were like, that guy's a liar. No one can walk 250 miles. Because like, we just could not fathom that at all. We're bicycling it. How could you walk this? And then here I am 10,000 miles later. But yeah, so I did, that was a big thing. So the outdoors were a very big component for me growing up. I was a misfit growing up. I'm, a very sensitive, goofy soul, and in my hometown it's a bit more suppressing and rigid. People are kind of judgmental, and if you're not the way that we all are, then you're gonna get bullied. And so I got into fighting a lot, and I was a good fighter, I guess. And so that was a big part for me, was stand up bare knuckle. That was kind of my preferred method, because I like the sportsmanship more than anything of fighting. It was less about like, oh, I'm angry. It was more about like, you're a jerk to me and I don't like you. Let's go meet on the train tracks and not bring any of our friends and put our dukes up and until someone says they're done. And that was kind of, it sometimes went that way, but for the most part, someone's eventually getting a bit carried away, but I always tried to keep it diplomatic. But so fighting was a big thing for me, and because of that was my sports growing up. Was I was a boxer, a Golden Gloves boxer. So I had a promising career in boxing, they told me I had a promising career in boxing. It's another thing to actually have a promising career in boxing. I was in a pro gym. So the whole goal was to turn me into a professional fighter. And then they would take, I think it was like 30% of my winnings. And then I would get to keep 70% of it. So the whole goal of the gym was to turn you into a professional fighter and then make money off of you. And it was kind of in a rough part of Kansas City. They called me at first the white welterweight because I was the only white kid there. But it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed boxing, and I got, I was supposed to become a professional boxer in, I think it was July of 2013. In the end we'll probably touch on that later. In the end, I had other plans, so I quit my career as a fighter. So.
Wow. Mega Man. Sometimes I ask a question and I get exactly what I expect. I kind of know what the answer is probably going to be and how it's going to play out. I went for a ride on that answer right there. That was a lot of fun just listening to all of that. There's a lot to unpack though. I've got some follow-up questions if you don't mind.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. So 10 siblings, what was the span of ages?
Okay. So
where did you fall in the birth order?
Yeah, so Hannah is the youngest, and if I am correct, she is 26 or 20. I think she's 26 right now. She's going to be 27 in May. And then the oldest is my brother Ben, and he is about 20 years older than me, and I'm 29. So he's about 49 years old. So yeah, 49 to 26 is the age range. And I'm the youngest of the boys, and then the second youngest of all 11 of us.
Okay. And how was it at dinner time? I mean, how many kids were at home at any one time? What was the greatest number of kids in the house at any one time?
I'd say that was probably whenever I was at my, toddler age. I remember, because it's a yours, mine, and ours things. My parents were both married before. So my dad had four kids, my mom had four kids, and then they got together and had three kids. And so I remember like growing up, all my dad's kids except Troy was living with us, so three of them. And then all four of my mom's kids were living there. And then at the time it was just me and Ashley because Hannah wasn't born yet. So that, what is that, nine people or eight or nine kids, something like that, that we had. But it would fluctuate all throughout my childhood. People would come in, leave, and, just according to whatever life threw at them. So, at this point, we're all scattered all over the place. Some are in Denmark. Some are down in Florida. A good few of us are here in Missouri. Some are down in Texas. Some are in California. So, yeah, we're all over the place.
Okay. Was it pretty chaotic in the house with that many people at times?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you've ever seen the show Malcolm in the Middle, that always resonated with me because I felt like, growing up in lower middle class environment and then having you know, all of your siblings just it, like, for instance, dinner was, to this day, I'm possessive of my food. And like whenever I'm eating my food, one thing I'm always criticized about is how I hold my utensils, because I grip my fork like as if, you know, like a barbarian, you know, I dig it in. And but it's I think it's just kind of like that fending thing where you know, I learned to eat quick, you grab food, and if you eat fast enough, then you can have seconds. So there was a lot of a lot of that kind of dynamic. But I mean, there was a lot of fighting, sure. But it felt normal. Like, and that's the thing, is like, I don't feel like there was any traumas that were created from it. The fighting did get excessive. Sometimes as little kids, whenever like the parents weren't around to catch us do this, you know, someone would grab a knife, a kitchen knife, and try to stab the other one and stuff. And so we had like fights like that, but it was never traumatic for me because I thought that that was just how upbringings were like. It wasn't until I started telling my friends about, you know, oh, my sister got me in the back with the knife the other day, and then they're like, that's not normal. And I had to really wrestle with like, your siblings don't fight like that either. But even though we fought a lot, we still, you know, loved each other, and it was a good time. It was just a very rowdy time, a big adrenaline rush half the time. So
nice. Now let's go to the bare knuckled fighting, because that's the surprising part to me, that we went there. You kind of have a look like you could fit into, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Snatch with Brad Pitt. Okay. So he plays an Irish gypsy who is a fantastic bare knuckled fighter. And, from your descriptions, I mean, it sounds like you'd fit right in. And then also, of course, the other movie references Fight Club.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So you ever seen that? So that sounds pretty wild. I mean, I like the fact that you try to keep it sportsmanlike, and just the, you know, you and your opponent at the tracks, and no friends allowed, and let's settle this like men.
Yeah. I really loved fighting. I mean, whenever I was little, and I think this, you know, might be like an evolution, or like a, not evolution, but animalistic thing, a thing that, you know, is like instilled in us back during the hunter-gatherer times, that in my brain as a kid, I thought if I was ever going to get a girl to like me, she had to know that I could fight. You know, that was, I thought that that was the most important thing. I wanted to be a really, really good fighter, because I thought, you know, that's my chance at getting a girlfriend and having the girls Google all over me and everything. It's not true. You know, I can say from experience that, you know, charisma goes a long way, and I don't have the most of that, but I like to fight. And I did a lot of fighting. I had boxing gloves too. And so a lot of times I would, you know, if I had problems with kids at school, I'd bring the gloves and then tell them to meet me in the bathroom or something, and we'd fight. And it's kind of funny the amount of people that talk this huge game, that they're like, yeah, one punch, you're going to do this, I'm going to do this, and knock. And I'm just like, yeah, let's find out. And then we put the gloves on, and I start wailing on them, and then they stop, and they start freaking out. And I always thought that was kind of comical to me. That was like probably the most fun part to me of fighting, is like everyone, for some odd reason, really loves to talk shit and just be like, oh, I'm so this and that. And then whenever it comes down to it, they've never been rocked before. And all of a sudden, now that their nose is broken, they're freaking out. And it was always kind of funny to me. But yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I was never like the like tough character, you know, like I've always been a goofball. I like to sing and dance and goof around and everything, but I love to fight. So a lot of times too, like whenever I had a career as a boxer and I'd go in the ring ready to fight someone, I'd walk in hunched over and kind of like, you know, try to look as like weak as I could, just to kind of, because a lot of times I've always been told I don't look like a good fighter. I look like this nerdy blonde kid. And so I love to like play that image, so that way people kind of let down their guard. So whenever it came down to it, I had that edge at the very beginning of expectation versus reality.
Mega Man, you are intriguing, because you are kind of a study in contradiction. You know, you're a self-described sensitive, goofy soul who is an excellent fighter. I mean, that just kind of, it's like oil and water kind of mixed into one person. Very interesting, very intriguing.
Yeah. I got, you know, that, I don't know. Maybe there was like a pre-mortal life and you get to pick a bunch of skill sets. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to make myself weird and complicated and put all these skills in certain areas. And then other areas, I was just like, no, none of it. Like, for instance, I can't throw a ball worth anything. My dad was a basketball player and a pitcher, and he really wanted me to be a baseball or basketball player. And then he found out that I'm just really bad at it, and I've never been good at it. All my friends like disc golfing, and I like to disc golf too, but I'm terrible at it. You know, I'm normally getting a double bogey on each hole is pretty commonplace for me. So it's just, you got some skills and you don't got others. And some of them you can work and train really hard at, and they're just not developing, and that's okay. That's just how, what you got in life. So
I love that you're building your character. You're allocating your skill points to different categories and said, you know what, this is what we're going to go with here.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, before we go to a break, how do you pay the bills? What do you do to finance your adventures?
To finance my adventures, a lot of it is living cheaply. It's also just picking up whatever job I can do. So like for the Appalachian Trail, I was a janitor. For the Pacific Crest Trail, I was a dishwasher at a restaurant. For the Continental Divide Trail, I did rough end carpentry. For a lot of the past ones, it's been door dashing, and that's kind of where I'm at still is. I just went through a breakup, and so now I'm back at my parents' place. And so the nice part about being back in my parents' place is it's cheap, so I can save up a lot of money and try to go off on more adventures. So that's what I'm doing right now, is just door dashing and saving up at my parents' place.
Well, sorry to hear about that breakup, but at least you can save some more money now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear some tales from the trail. We'll talk about some of your Triple Crown adventures, as well as some other stories, including your most recent Florida trail experience. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back. From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Six Moon Designs has been innovating ultralight backpacking gear for the past 20 years. With a wide range of products ranging from ultralight shelters to backpacks and accessories like their extensive line of trekking umbrellas, Six Moon Designs is sure to have a great piece of gear for your needs. With the company philosophy being that gear should aid one's experience, not define it, Six Moon Designs thinks the more time people spend outside the natural world, the better off this world will be. And remember, go wild, live young. And welcome back. We are talking to Mega Man, the sensitive, goofy soul who can box your socks off and probably much more. So, again, thank you for agreeing to talk tonight. This has been fantastic so far. Before we get to your Triple Crown hikes, I've got another trail listed here in our discussion points that I have never heard of before. So you have to enlighten us as to what it is, where it is, how long it is. It's the Ma Da Hay Trail.
Yeah, the Mata Hay Trail. Yeah.
Mata Hay. Okay.
Yeah. So that's in North Dakota. It's 144 miles. And it's the longest trail in North Dakota. And if you don't include the Great Plains Trail, because it kind of is a trail, but I think two people have done it and it's still under a lot of work. If you don't include that one, it's the longest trail in the Great Plains, but it's in Theodore Roosevelt National Park and also Little Missouri National Grassland, which is the largest national grassland in the States, which may not sound too intriguing for most people, but it's, this whole area is a big old Badlands area. So everything's eroded buttes, which is you know, for geology and looking at fossils and everything, it's amazing. Because there's old sequoia, fossilized sequoias, and hundreds of bison. I saw one person while I was out there. Yeah, it's a really beautiful trail just on the west part of North Dakota. And, you know, then in South Dakota, there's the Black Hills Centennial Trail, which is 128 miles. And they're roughly about 100 miles from each other. So it's kind of cool because you can really, if you want to make a trip out of it, you can go do the Centennial Trail, the longest trail in South Dakota, and then go up and do the Mottahay Trail, longest trail in North Dakota, and say you hike the longest trail in the Dakotas.
Now, is there a trail or a path that connects the two where you could walk the entire thing, or you'd have to take a car?
Yeah, there is the Great Plains Trail, like I was talking about earlier. That trail or route connects. I'm not too sure if it connects both of them or if the Great Plains Trail goes on the Mickelson Trail, which is a rail trail in the Black Hills, or if it's one of those like choose your side, you can take the Centennial Trail or the Mickelson Trail. I would honestly think it would be pretty easy to just go and hike the Centennial Trail rather than the Mickelson Trail and then, you know, walk your way up there. And it's honestly not an ugly, if you were to walk, it's not an ugly walk because you have a lot of just big, big plateaus and unique geologic structures that you can look at on the way. It's very vast and open, but there's also not a lot of houses. So it feels very wild. And growing up, I was never a fan of the Great Plains because I always associated it with farmland. But then once when you see it in its natural state with natural grasslands and the natural animals and everything there and the big skies and the amazing storms that go through, it's such a beautiful area. And I've definitely fallen in love with the Great Plains after hiking both those trails.
Nice. They sound majestic. I mean, just gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now the PCT, AT and the CDT, is that the order that you did them in or did you do the AT first?
I did the AT first. Yeah.
AT first. What year was that?
That was 2016.
And what was your inspiration for deciding to do one of the three American long trails? And what was your first introduction to the American long trails? And I've talked to some people who just had their mind blown, didn't realize that such a thing existed, that like a trail from Georgia to Maine or from Mexico to Canada, that you could walk the whole thing.
Yeah, so I definitely got a story to this one that you probably never heard before. I mean, to start it off, this one's not too amazing, but I remember going on vacation down to Florida when we were kids, and we stopped in Tennessee, and we were on a trail, and my dad's like, oh, do you know what trail this is? I'm like, no. He's like, oh, this is the Appalachian Trail. It goes from Georgia to Maine. I was like, cool. And he's like, yeah, people quit their jobs and go and hike this, and takes them like 4, 5, 6 months. I was like, wait, so adults can just quit their job and do this? And he's like, yeah, and there's actually three of them. I was like, that like changed my mind, like changed my world, because ever since I was a little kid, like I had Peter Pan syndrome so badly. Just adulthood sounded like just responsibilities and self-enslavement, getting stuck with a career and getting stuck with bills and whining kids and a nagging spouse and just like all these problems. And I was like, why would anybody want that? I have to be stuck in school for till I'm 18 years old and then go and do this. That sounds terrible. But then.
So your dad planted the seed right then and there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He's the one who made me think about it. So, to carry on with like the chronology of my end of my boxing career, I actually quit boxing to become a Mormon missionary. So at that point I went back to the Mormon church and I decided, I really wanted to, as far as like figuring things out, because with Mormonism, epistemology is such a big factor in it. The idea of knowing, and in it, they have a thing called bearing your testimony, and everyone will say, I know this, I know that, I know that God loves me, I know all this stuff. And I didn't have any of that. So I was like, and my parents were always like, oh, we have one. So I was like, well, I need to go and find this out for myself. So I go off on this mission. You don't get to pick your mission. So the church picks it and sends it back. And they tell me that I'm going to Roseville, California, the Roseville, California mission, which is right above Sacramento. And then it goes up to Weed, California. So it's really in that like Sacramento Valley area in Northern California. Mount Shasta is part of that. And one of the amazing things I found out whenever I was looking at it on a map was to the east of it was the Pacific Crest Trail. So right there was like, oh man, am I, because a Mormon mission is 2 years long. And I was like, can I do this? Am I going to be able to make it, or am I gonna run to the mountains? So I fly out there and I serve for about 9 months and it's not working for me. I'm having a really hard time. I'm not getting the answers I needed. I was praying frantically, fasting, trying to, you know, be as spiritually minded as I could, because I was in this state where I was like, God, I can't do this anymore. I can't go and knock on doors and tell people stuff that I don't know is true, and having a lot of doubts on. So I was like, either some divine intervention, I need someone to, you know, a light to come down, or some kind of strong feeling to tell me this, or else I'm out of here. And I remember going to the Sacramento Temple, and I fasted for 2 days and really tried to prepare myself and prayed and felt nothing, and came back, and I had this thought come to my head, kind of like a little internal conversation, and the voice in my head was like, well, where do you feel the most spiritually alive? And I was like, well, that's out in the wild. And it's like, well, go to the wild then. And that was like just a big aha moment. And so I look over at the map of our mission and I see Lake Tahoe and I see the Pacific Crest Trail right there. And so my original plan was I was going to get on the PCT, head north until I got to Canada, jump the border illegally, go to Alaska, and then just see if I can make it or die. That was kind of the original plan. I had no idea what I was doing, no research. I bought 2 backpacks full of like survival gear. It was roughly like 80 pounds. And that ended up becoming my first trail name, was 2-pack, because I had 2 backpacks. But yeah, so I decided I was going to run. The Mormon Church found out. They sent a bunch of missionaries to catch me in the middle of the night. And so that kind of hastened my decision, where I was originally going to kind of comfortably leave early in the morning. But I all of a sudden realized like, oh, I got to go. So I, in the middle of the night, sometime around midnight, I grabbed my 2 backpacks, told my companion I'm out of here, got on my bike and just zoomed off, and ended up going to this girl's house who was an anti-Mormon. So I knew like she would be the most comfortable person to hang around with while I try to figure out how I'm going to make it to South Lake Tahoe. I hang out at her house for about 2 days. But he wasn't really like a boyfriend, but he was a guy friend who liked her. And he didn't like that I was in the picture. And so I bribed him. I told him, hey, I will get out of the picture and I'll give you my bike if you drive me to South Lake Tahoe. And so he, of course, took that offer and drove me from Roseville to South Lake Tahoe. And that was my introduction to hiking, was running from a Mormon mission to live out in the woods and find God my own way. I hiked about 200 miles before getting really sick. I can't say exactly what it was. My best theory is arsenic poisoning, because I was living mainly off of almonds and walnuts. And apparently if you just eat those and don't eat anything else and you're working hard and everything, you're going to get sick. And so that was what I was doing. So I think that's what happened. But I got really, really sick, had to get off trail around the Quincy LaPorte Road in Northern California. So I ended up walking 11 miles down on this road, laying down to die like 3 times from dehydration and just pure exhaustion, thinking this is it. And then laying there and be like, I'm not dead yet, getting back up and continuing walking, made down to this little town. Called my family. They didn't pick up at the time because the they just didn't pick up the phone. I left a voicemail, and I'm sure I sounded really sick. So I go and set up camp. The next day I go down into town, and the town is like all in a kerfuffle. They're all frustrated. And I'm like, hey, what's going on? They're like, 2 guys who kind of look like you just came down here and we're asking for you. But since you told us your story, we know what's up and we know that they're the Mormons and everything. And like, we chased them off. And so, the little town kind of like had my back and chased off the Mormon missionaries. And then I just, you know, I called my family, and within a couple of days they drove out to pick me up. And, that stuck in my mind. I think it was like a 10-day adventure, and I got to meet hikers. I got to learn everything I was doing wrong. That's why the way I hike is because of that adventure. I met a guy who, you know, he was making fun of the food I ate. And I was like, well, what should you eat? And he's like, Snicker bars and Slim Jims. And that's still, that's a staple still to this day. So, and the funny thing is, to this day, I'm known as the runaway missionary out there for the Mormons. And every so often I'll get messages from missionaries out there who'll be like, hey, are you the runaway missionary? And so it's kind of cool. I became this tall tale. I've heard their story too. And it's become this really big exaggerated story where it's like I stole a police car and stuff, which of course isn't true, but but still it's a, you know, to this day I look back and think, what was I doing? You know, I took off and escaped from like 20 missionaries trying to catch me.
Mega Man, that is epic. And I just have one question. Who's gonna play you in the movie? Because this is a movie script right here. This is nothing. I would pay money to see this story on the big screen.
Well, I've talked about this appeal because you're not the first one to bring that up. And we all agreed if Owen Wilson can look young enough, I think he should play the role because he's another blonde guy. He also has a broken nose like me. So I think he might be the role.
I think we've got to pitch it to him.
Yeah.
Let's go. All right. And Snicker bars and Slim Jims, the staple of Mega Man's trail diet now.
Pretty much. Yeah.
No more arsenic poisoning.
Nope. Not sick.
Okay. So what year did you do the AT?
I did the AT in 2016.
Okay. And when you completed the AT, at what point did you know that you were going to do another American Long Trail or all three of them? Did you know at that point you're going to be a triple crowner?
No. I thought the AT was going to be it for me. I thought that was like my one run. And then I'd need to go to college and try to apply myself and create a career. I was like really dreading that, but I came back home and started working, trying to get out of debt. And then I heard about that it was a record high snow year in the PCT. And the PCTA was telling everyone, don't go out in the Sierras. It's super dangerous in 2017. And I love danger. And so for me, that was like an invitation to go hike the PCT that year. So that was what made me decide, oh, I'm going to northbound the Pacific Crest Trail in 2017 was because of all the stuff I kept seeing, mountaineers and all these people saying, don't do the PCT this year. And I was really excited for that. So
now you did a northbound trip of the PCT 2017. You did southbound on the AT.
Yeah.
A year before. Now I interviewed another guest last night. Maybe you've heard of him. He was also out on the PCT in 2017. In fact, he made the PCT an out and back trail. He yo-yoed it. Okay. I talked to Airborne last night.
That sounds familiar. I don't think I talked to him, but I definitely heard the name tossed around.
Yeah. He went through the Sierras that year. He had to start really early. Because he knew he was going up and back. And so he went through the Sierras in April of that year.
Jeez, that's crazy.
Yeah. Okay. And so which did you like better? Did you prefer the AT or the PCT?
I preferred the PCT. I like both of them a lot. I love the love that's put on the AT, but the more wildernessy aspect of the PCT plus the year that we had, the year of fire and ice and everything, it was just everything I could have wished for in a through hike. So to this day, the PCT, or at least that time I went through hiked it, it was my favorite hiking experience.
Yeah, I think the PCT has a lot going for it. It's got like five different ecological zones, maybe, or five different personalities. You got the desert, and you got the Sierras, and you got Northern California, and then of course, Oregon and Washington. Did you have a particular favorite piece of that trail?
I really liked Washington. I thought it was very beautiful. I mean, the Sierras were really beautiful too. I got in them at the end of May. So I was a little bit on the early side too. Not quite as early as Airborne, but it was amazing for me. Just, the men that you went over, I can't remember which pass. I mean, honestly, going over Forrester Pass and then just seeing the snow everywhere, and that was kind of like the welcome to the Sierras, nothing but snow and just it was an amazing time at that year, you know, it kind of like talking about the boxing days where everyone's talking this big game, like, oh, I'm going to do this and that. Talking to northbound through hikers of the PCT, they were like, I'd ask them, are you going through the Sierras? And like, of course I'm going through the Sierras. And they're all so confident and arrogant in it. And then it was kind of funny watching all of them, or a lot of them, skip it or get off trail or do things like that. And for good reason, you know, it was very dangerous, but yeah, it was a lot of fun to go through and try to puzzle solve and figure things out. And those river crossings were crazy, especially in Yosemite. But it was definitely my kind of flavor of hiking.
Nice. Now, did you ever find yourself in a position where you thought to yourself, what am I doing out here? I've gotten myself into a predicament that I'm not sure I can get out of.
I don't know if there was like a particular time where that happened. I certainly had like a lot of near deaths where like I fell off the side of mountains going down snow walls and towards like either big trees or rivers and thinking, oh, this is it. Or yeah, I remember like one of the, I think it was the second river crossing we had. The first one was not too bad. It was about waist deep and, you know, you just took your time. The second one, though, we couldn't pass it. And so I was with this other guy, Dasani, and me and him walked way upstream to find a snow bridge and threw our backpacks over, ran and jumped over it, and then looked back and realized that the snow bridge wasn't even connected. It was pretty teetered out. And so if we would have, like, tried to utilize what we thought, you know, tried to just run across, we would have fallen in and died. But that kind of stuff is, you know, for me, it's fun. And there was one time I was really PO'd because we were going down Kearsarge Pass to get to the road. And I saw what looked like a trail on the left side. And he insisted, because he saw some footprints, to take the right side. And we argued this back and forth for a good while. And we ended up, I'm like, fine, let's just take the right side. And so ends up being the snow wall where you're digging your fingers in the snow and kicking and going across that way. And the snow wall decides to go out. And so down I go. And I didn't have an ice axe with me in the Sierras. I didn't have crampons. I just had micro spikes and I had a broken trekking pole, half a trekking pole. And so I tried to lodge that trekking pole in to slow me down and self-arrest. It wasn't quite working, and got down to where there were some bushes and grabbed at the bushes and tore my hands up. And probably, I don't know, 8 feet away from me, if I would have kept tumbling, is this huge drop off in a waterfall, and I would have died there. And so I lost one of my micro spikes. I climbed back up and I'm just livid. I'm so angry at Dasani for deciding to go to the right side. I would not talk to him. We go back down to the road and we hitch into Bishop, and we go to the McDonald's and I eat a burger, and my hanger goes away. I'm instantly happy again. I'm seeing people around me crying and being all somber, and me and him are like, I just get excited. I'm like, oh, you know what? We're gonna go back in there and we're gonna either hike or die. And we just kept like chanting, we're like, hike or die, and that kind of became like our motto. And it was just like this switch that happened in these years where it's like, all right, it's time to be crazy and reckless and wild. And I just got to be as free and reckless and wild and me versus nature on the edge of death all the time. And it was just pure ecstasy for me. I was having a lot of fun.
For some reason, McDonald's hamburgers don't have the same effect on me. You know,
really?
Yeah. Just going crazy.
Oh, yeah. Making it crazy. Yeah. But making you happy.
It flipped the switch for you.
Yeah. I mean, I was rationing at that point. So a lot of my anger, I think, too, was just low calorie intake and fatigue. So,
right. Now, what did you think of the CDT? Because I know you said that, you know, PCT is your favorite. AT is kind of, you know, the green tunnel. It's close to a lot of populated areas. I mean, you're never that far away from civilization. Yeah. What did you think of the CDT?
CDT was awesome. I was kind of disappointed because like the AT, we had the Gatlinburg fires. And so I went through those fires and that was kind of exciting. And so there was a lot of challenges on that trail. I had that stress fracture where I got my trail name and neurovirus. And I went blind during that because I kept hiking and got probably not enough like electrolytes or sodium in me or something. I got real sick, but yeah. And then the PCT, the year of fire and ice, it was, and the CDT was low snow year. It's a 10% snowpack in the San Juans. And there was really no sign of anything being dangerous. And that was like kind of a buzzkill for me because I was really hoping for this extreme, dangerous, crazy thing. But at first, like the CDT was just this cakewalk. We're doing 38 miles every day and just cruising along. And I'm just having.
Was this 2018?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you did them in successive years, 3 years in a row. And did you do, I know you did the AT southbound and the PCT northbound. Did you do the CDT northbound as well?
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
At that point, I was just chomping at the bit to go for the triple and everything. So, I go out there and it was, you know, the San Juans were, I mean, there was a lot of post holing, but it wasn't dangerous. It was kind of a cakewalk. Colorado was pretty easy. It was just like not challenging for me. But then I got to Yellowstone area and that's where things just took a big old twist for the worse. And that's where I had like my big trail, I don't know what you call it, the climax of my trail career as far as like stories and craziness happens.
Let me put my seatbelt on. Let's hear this one.
Yeah, this is where I was attacked by a grizzly bear. It was about 7 miles south of Yellowstone. I was in the greater Yellowstone area and I was hiking with this other guy, Captain Kirk, and my headphones decided to quit working. So I told him, hike on ahead. I'm going to fiddle with my headphones. At the time, I didn't have bear spray, and as most hikers, I didn't have a gun or anything. So he hikes on ahead. I get to the top of this plateau, probably, I don't know, a mile or half a mile behind him, and there's a grizzly bear right on the trail. And so I step off the trail, try to go around, pull up my camera, film it a little bit. Oh, look, a grizzly bear. And you can see this on my Instagram channel, not the attack, but like right before the attack, I'm filming it. And there's like a part I'm like, oh, he's curiously coming my way though, because he started, you know, he'd have his head down and kind of moving it from side to side, and he'd kind of look my way and then just kind of start walking my way and then stop and then kind of shift around. And so I had this feeling like, oh, well, he notices me, so what's going to happen? I thought, you know, statistically no hikers died from a grizzly bear attack, so how am I going to be the one, you know? I was like, yeah, as far as stats go, I should be a-okay. And sure enough, he decides to charge me, and I was like, oh, so this is how I go. But, you know, me being the fighter type and everything, I always had this fantasy of dying fighting, the warrior's death kind of thing. And so it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, now I'm getting what I wanted. I was kind of disappointed I wasn't going to be a triple crowner, but I was like, well, this is it. So so he charges at me, and I grab my trekking pole and I lift it over my head and I yell real loud, hey, bear. And he stops about 10 feet from me and, you know, stomps his front paws. And every time I look back to try to back walk, he decides that he wants to charge me again. So I realized real quickly, because I know the general backcountry bear rules, that you're not supposed to look them in the eyes because that's challenging them, and you're supposed to play docile and get on the ground in the fetal position. But I realized real quickly, I was like, oh, shoot, this young adult male grizzly, he, every time that I lock eyes with him and get aggressive back at him, he stops. But the minute that I look away, he charges. I realized real quick, oh, this is a predator bear. He's trying to see if he can get me. And so at that point, it was like, all right, I gotta, you know, go into my fight mode. And so, you know, he charged me maybe 8 or 9 times, because, you know, occasionally I'd stumble on something, look back to make sure I'm not going to trip. And then he would charge me again. I'd yell, he'd stop, each time getting a little bit closer. Eventually, he kind of just decides to get bored and he just starts, you know, eating the grass and walking around. So I start walking away. I get to this snowy section and I slip on the snow, and instantly he turns, gets real excited and charges at me. And I'm like, damn it. And so I thought, you know, this was the one where I felt pretty certain, like, oh, this is the charge that's going to get me. So I found a stone near me. I lifted it over my head, screamed as loud as I could, and was like, all right, I'm going to bash this bear in the head. I know it's not going to do anything, but, you know, I got to die fighting. That's how I'm going to make it to Valhalla if I want to go there. So I scream at him and charge at him. And the minute that he sees that this crazy Homo sapien is deciding that, oh, he's going to charge me, then he got scared, turned, and tried to run. So now all of a sudden, I'm chasing this grizzly bear, trying to get him to go away. And then all of a sudden, he realizes, oh, I'm the king of the woods here. Like, you're just a hairless ape. And so he stops, gives me this angry side glare. I'm standing above him, feeling his hot breath on my legs. And I'm just like with this stone over my head, ready to bash it on his head. And that voice that I've had pop up in my head periodically that told me to run from my mission and everything, it was telling me, it was like, don't hit this bear in the head with a rock. You're going to die if you do that. And I was like, well, I don't got much of a choice at this point, do I? Like, you know, he's not going away. I have no choice but to fight him. And it's like, you're not going to die. I was like, what do you mean I'm not going to die? Like, he's not getting away from me. And it's like, just don't do it. And so I was like, okay. So I lower the stone, I start back walking, he just stands there. And at that point, we're like, all right, we're cool. So the grizzly bear is hanging out there, I keep walking. I can't get to the trail because of where he's at, so I jump off the side of a snow wall on the side of the mountain and slide down, start walking on kind of like, you know, a wait a minutes go by, 30, 45 minutes. And all of a sudden I hear behind me some crunchy noises. And I look back and I'm kind of cliffed out at this point, because I'm on this really rocky terrain. And I look back and I realize, oh shoot, the grizzly bear has been stalking me. And here he is again. And so now I'm cliffed out. I have nowhere to go. And he's coming at me. And so I'm trying to think of my options. And I look down and the voice in my head, it says, you got to jump. And I'm looking down the cliffside. I'm like, if I jump, it's probably not going to kill me, but it's going to break my legs. And it's like, you got to jump, because it's a slope, but it's a good 50 foot jump or so, you know, I can't quite tell you the exact measurements, but it was a good, he gets close. I end up jumping. I tumble 2-3 times before I hit the ground, tried to land each of my falls on my backpack. My hands got pretty bloody. My hip was pretty bloody. But overall I was functional. So I made it down to the valley and looked up, and the grizzly bear is looking down at me, and he kind of looks around thinking, how can I get down and get him? And so now it's like, you know, now I got to be really clever, because right next to me is some woods to the right and behind me is a field. And I look at both and I realize I can run in the field, but that bear can go 35 miles an hour. I can't run that fast. He's going to get me. But the woods are really compact, so there's my chance to get away. So I go into the woods, climb over stuff, maneuver around and everything, and end up scrambling back up the side of a mountain. I record this video thinking that I'm going to die. So I record a little video where I'm like whispering and like, hey, I'm in this area and a grizzly bear is stalking me, just as like my last little, so everyone knows whenever they find my body parts in a bear, what happened. But that was it. You know, I got up and climbed up and I got away from the grizzly bear. I ended up doing, I think it was like a 39 mile day. I was crying the whole day, just in a complete mess. And I got to camp and Captain Kirk was there and he's looking at me and he's kind of like, where have you been? And I was like, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. And he looks at the blood and looks at me and he's like, you were attacked by a grizzly. And I, you know, just started sobbing and told him, and it was terrifying. But I can say to this day, I survived a grizzly bear attack. So
Mega Man, that is a story of a lifetime right there. That is incredible. I am struck by a couple of things. One is your initial thought that you were disappointed that you wouldn't be a triple crowner. You know, of all the things to be disappointed about, you know, knowing you're going to meet your end here with a grizzly bear, that really speaks to kind of your passion for hiking.
Yeah. Yeah. I love hiking. I live for it. And that was, you know, I've always wanted to make it my life and my career, and it's been a difficult battle, but I feel like I'm making these little steps, you know, being on this podcast and being on newspapers and stuff. I'm slowly making it there. And I have this way of attracting these crazy stories. And I want these crazy stories. I'll say this. I don't want to be attacked by a grizzly again. But if I was not attacked by a grizzly, I would say I would have wanted to be attacked by a grizzly just to have that story. Like, I want that experience. And it was mainly also to feel what it's like to be prey and to feel not on the top of the food chain. And that was a very raw and uncomfortable feeling, but such a real feeling. Like, you like talk about living life and like actually feeling what life is. That situation just pulled that in together. It was extremely uncomfortable and scary, and anger was the main feeling going through me. But at the same time, I came through it alive and have this amazing story. And so I'm very grateful for the experience.
I have a bit of advice, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
That is, the next time you come face to face with that grizzly bear, you slowly reach into your pack, you pull out the boxing gloves, and you say, "Hey, let's go over to the train tracks and settle this thing like men."
I like that idea. I think I could get more punches in, but I think I couldn't hurt him. I think in the end of a boxing match, me versus a bear, if he was to play fair and jab at me, I think it would be a stalemate where I'm just worn out and I'm like, I can't hit you anymore. And he would be like, I don't know how to work these things.
Right. Maybe a broken nose or open up a cut above the eye. Maybe you have a shot, but what a story. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Now I have to ask, when you got to Florida, you just got off the trail for the Florida trail. Any encounters with gators?
I mean, I saw gators, but no, I had a really tame hike on the Florida trail. It was, I guess I had this shift in hiking whenever I started getting to a relationship. Well, it was getting to a relationship and also having a bunch of failures after the CDT, because, you know, post-trail depression is a thing. And I crashed really hard after the Triple Crown, because that was my life goal. And I just achieved it. And I was like, well, now what? How can I do more dangerous and crazy adventures? Originally, I was wanting to take a rowboat and row across the Atlantic, that like do like a Viking voyage, start up in maybe like Nova Scotia, go to Greenland, Iceland, then stop in Norway. But, you know, I started learning, oh, this stuff costs a lot of money, and I'm still living in my parents' basement doing dead end jobs. Like, I can't do this stuff. I have the passion, but I don't have the means for it. So, I crashed really, really hard after that. And, you know, attempted the, well, first I tried to ditch society after my Triple Crown, January 1st, 2019. I said, if I don't, you know, if I can't figure out what I'm going to do in my life, I'm just going to get away from humanity and just live out in the woods and just enjoy myself. And I went down to the Mexican border at Big Bend National Park. And while hanging out in some hot springs, I had a rock that I actually pulled off of the hot springs go and hit my foot, and it caused a gash, which, you know, was pretty bad and sprayed and everything. And so I couldn't walk with my foot. And I was like, well, how can I ditch society if my foot's not working? And so I ended up at that point driving to my sister's house in Florida, and my foot at that point was swelled up really badly. And I ended up getting really sick after about a week. Everyone was telling me I need to go to the hospital. I'm like, I don't have any medical insurance. I'm not going to ruin my future going to the hospital. I woke up ready to vomit one night, and I found this black thing in the gash, and I pulled it, and it ended up being a little rock, and pus and everything came out, and about three more rocks came out, and all of a sudden I could walk again. So that was like, oh, I can walk again. So that was like the start of 2019. And then I went to do the PNT, and I started on the ocean section, Olympic National Park, and I was being arrogant as I do, unfortunately. And this ranger was telling me you can't do 30 mile days in the ocean. And so I was just like, well, bet. And so I did a 30 mile day. And then I was like, all right, I'm going to finish up the ocean section, but I wasn't paying at all attention to the tide charts and just thought like, you know, I've survived a grizzly. I can do this. And end up in one of the parts where maybe whenever the tide's low enough, you can just walk around it. But there's this hole that's in the wall. I don't think it is hole in the wall per se, because it's kind of a smaller hole, but it was filling up with water from the ocean. And I tried to crawl through and I couldn't make it through. And so like this ocean water is coming in and whacking me and pushing me against the wall. And then I had to take my backpack off and push it through. And by the time I made it through, my phone was broke. And so without navigation, I couldn't do the PNT. So I crashed. And on top of that, I was on a time crunch because I had a friend who had a wedding in Rhode Island by August. So I was hoping to finish by then. I was like, well, shoot, this is too much pressure. I'm going to get off this trail and instead try the Arizona Trail in the middle of June. And so I go down to the Arizona Trail and hike about 200 miles of it, get to Flagstaff going southbound. And I'm just lost my passion. I was so defeated from the PNT and from trying to ditch society and failing and everything that I was just like, you know what, maybe hiking's not for me anymore. And I got on a Greyhound and they lost all my gear. And so I come back home without backpack or anything, and you know, calling them all the time like, hey, you know, I'm pretty sure it's in this spot, can you check? And they never found it. And it was just like a really hard thing for me. So I was just, you know, very lost at that point. But then I got a girlfriend, and that kind of like set my mind towards that, and that really helped me at the time. And I started focusing more on the educational side of hiking, specifically like physiography and geology and everything. And I started really getting into just maps and in general, and maps without man-made borders, so without physical or human geography. So not the state of Missouri, it's, you know, in the south part is the interior highlands, and then kind of like that. And so I wanted to hike every physiographical region in the United States on a long trail. That was kind of my next goal, and to make the other focus less about the physical danger and more about the educational side of me experiencing these landscapes and learning about them beforehand. And so I you know, that was why I did the trails that I did, was as a focus to do all 8 major physiographical regions. And the last one for me was down in the Atlantic Plains, which is where the Florida Trail is. And so I figured that would be the perfect trail. And on top of that, whenever I did that, that would grant me 10,000 miles of hiking. And that was a big goal for me. So I put all that together and went off and did the Florida Trail, and did it more as like an educational purpose for me, more to understand that area and find the beauty in it more than to experience danger and wrestle alligators.
Now, having done all 8, you've completed all 8 regions, right? Yeah, Florida was your last one, the plains up there.
Yeah, the Atlantic Plains. Yep.
The Atlantic Plains. And so what is your impression after having gone through all those regions? What have you learned?
The big thing that I've learned, this is kind of like a staple thing for me, is that everything that's wild is beautiful. You know, you'll hear people talk about, they're like, oh, but the mountains are the most beautiful and this and that's the most beautiful. Anywhere that's a wilderness area that doesn't have a bunch of residential commercial areas where society's not at, it's beautiful. It's equally beautiful. I can't really at this point in my life say, oh, this one's more beautiful than the other. It's just the more wild something is, the more beautiful it is to me. The more, you know, just being surrounded by tons of life. And it's, that was the big thing. I remember, on the Florida Trail, for me, like a lot of it too, is tapping into what made, cause humans for the longest period of time, Homo sapiens were hunter gatherers. And that's what probably made us happy, was going out, killing some food, bringing it back, cooking it. Great, gave us fulfillment. We're traveling around by foot, and suddenly we don't have that anymore. And for me, a lot of it was to tap back into that part of myself and to see if that can grant me some happiness. And so another thing that I found on the Florida Trail, it was during a mushroom trip, so I kind of felt this way anyway, but I was just walking around seeing these gnarly trees and was like, oh, you know what, I'm going to climb these trees. And then this revelation came to me about being a great ape, you know, that we're classified as great apes. It was something that kind of like took it different, because it has a different perspective than human. Whenever I hear human, I feel like the word human separates itself from animal. And that to me feels really wrong. I think that we are animals. We're just animals that have gotten really good at making tools and all this stuff. And so for me, the idea, like the word great ape, or like just even calling it Homo sapiens, like that to me resonated so much more because it more felt what I was as opposed to the societal view of it. So that was another big thing for me.
Nice. Now, Mega Man, I know you have a lot more stories. I can sense that there are a lot of stories in you, and you've been a great guest. We're running out of time, and so I would like to try and get a commitment from you to come back for a future episode of the John Freaking Muir Pod and share some more stories with us.
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Fantastic. Hey, you know where we are right now?
No, what? Like the picture behind you or?
The pro tip insight of the week.
Oh, we're at that time of the episode where I turn to you for some trail wisdom to share with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. So what bit of advice do you have to share with our listeners?
All right. So the one that I thought about, and this goes back to the grizzly bear experience. This one to me was very important because if I didn't go by this rule, I probably would have been dead. The rule that I have is learn your bear. And it's not per se black bear does this, a grizzly bear does that, polar bear does this. I don't agree with that. I really think just like humans, bears have their own personalities. Every animal does. Anytime that you have an animal situation, the first thing I think that's important is not to just go by, oh, this is the rules, this is what I need to do. The first thing you need to do is to analyze and say, what's this animal's intentions? What's it trying to accomplish here? And then to work in accordance to that. With the grizzly bear, it probably would have ended up really bad if I just laid in the fetal position. And a lot of predatory grizzly bears, you have to be more aggressive and loud at them. And then sometimes with black bears, you got to be more, docile and retreating. The other thing is, the typical getting the fetal position with grizzly bears, that's going to more correlate to mother grizzlies. And it makes sense because you're wanting to look as non-threatening as possible. But young adult male grizzly bears behave very differently. So for all these hikers out here, when you're out in the back country and everything, and you run into an animal, and if you do it enough, you certainly will, learn, observe it and try to figure out what its intentions are, because that will help save your life a lot more than just following a checklist of what people say to do.
I love it. Learn your bear, yeah. not just the different types of species and how they typically act, but there are individuals within each species type, and learn which one you're dealing with.
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. So there you have it. That's it. This episode is just about in the books. Hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Mega Man. Want to thank him for joining us this week. Mega Man, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media, and where can they find updates on your latest adventures?
Yeah, so the best one probably is my Instagram, vagrant_viking93. The other one is my YouTube channel, which is also in a link on my Instagram. It's just, I don't have like a lot of hiking videos. It's mainly just like condensed hiking videos, like the Mottahay Trail in 5 minutes or the Superior Hiking Trail in 5 minutes. So I just want it to be nature oriented and not me talking about myself and look at me kind of thing. I want just to be like, people want to go and hike these trails, this is what the trails look like. So my YouTube channel is called Wild West. It's probably easier though to find if you're on my Instagram channel, which is vagrant_viking93.
Okay. Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We're on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmuir@gmail.com.
The Adventure Media Recommendation.
And before we wrap things up, I'm also looking to you to share a recommendation for a book, a movie, documentary, some kind of media that keeps our listeners connected to the outdoors. We're calling this our Adventure Media Recommendation. What do you have for us?
You know, I really like the documentary Paddle to Seattle. I don't know if anyone's recommended that one before. I watched on Amazon Prime. It's a documentary about two guys who have hiked the Appalachian Trail together, and now they're paddling from Alaska down to Seattle in some oceanic rowboat I think they're kayaks, actually, oceanic kayaks. And it's just it captures that goofy hiker trash essence so well, that so many documentaries get so serious and everything. But this one's just, it captures what I love about being a hiker, the silliness of it. So Paddle to Seattle.
Okay, very nice.
What have we not asked you?
And before we wrap things up, we have one more segment for you called what have we not asked you that you're dying to tell us about? What can we fit into it? Another brief little segment here.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. There ain't much. I've been talking a good bit. I'd say we're good here. So, yeah.
Okay. So that's a wrap from the John Freaky Mirror Studio. Any shout outs to friends and family, Mega Man?
Yeah. Shout out
a lot of siblings to go through. Don't forget anybody.
Oh, if you want me to do that. Yeah. Troy, Justin, Jacob, John, Tobias, Sabina, Rebecca. I think I said Ben. If I didn't, Ben, then Ashley and Hannah. And I don't even want to try my nieces and nephews. There's way too many of them. Shout out to some of my hiking friends, Top and Double D and Bear Magnet, Captain Kirk, Dasani, Hell Yeah Jesus. Love you guys. You're all awesome. So.
Now, how did you end up with Mega Man and not Bear Magnet if you're the one that got attacked by the bear?
Well, mine came on the Appalachian Trail, so it was early on for me, but Bear Magnet, he saw, it was like, I can't remember the exact number, like 30 or 40 something bears on the Appalachian Trail, and somewhere in like, I feel like it was like 10 to 20 black bears in the Shenandoahs alone, so that's where and how he got his trail name.
Does he slather himself with like bear pheromones or something?
You know, he has a certain smell to him. It might be the smell that bears like, but I don't know. I don't know why he gets so many bears his way. I was hoping for some bears on the Florida Trail, but I did see one, but it was just its butt while I was running away in Osceola National Forest. But yeah.
Well, this has been a great episode. Really appreciate you spending some time with us. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if you've just logged 39 miles after a grizzly attack. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck.